So we lost some folks from last week.
Or they're late, one or the other.
Oh, that too, okay. All right, so they're scared. They are cats. So we're going to start with a brief review from last week, just in case we have some folks who weren't here last week. Tonight we're talking about social and emotional development. Those two things are related to one another. When we have very good emotional development, we also have very good social development. And so when we have an obstacle with one, we have an obstacle with the other. And then next week, we're talking about attachment and parenting. So Steve Sapp sent me a little glib this week. Do I have a... Oh, I forgot to turn this on. So much better when it's turned on. I think so.
Yep, should be.
There we go. But that was cute. It was our little poor doggy. That's what happens when you have a teen and younger children at home, right? Your poor younger children are the dog, and your teen just smacks them around. Okay. So we had some questions. Andrew had a question about fruits of the Spirit. And we were talking about parts of the brain and how they help with self-control. And his question was, what about the other fruits of the Spirit? So we're actually going to get to that tonight. But here's the scripture. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, forbearance, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Against such things there is no law. Okay, and then I had a question from my Steve Fisher example, the basketball. What do you do when your child needs correction on their layup? I think that's legitimate, right? Because not all children are going to have a perfect layup as they go to the basket. So with this, and we'll talk a lot more about this when we do the parenting workshop next week, I showed the clip, Steve, from the you missed it. Yeah. The challenge is to do correction and not do criticism or punishment when you're doing correction. So if your child's trying to learn how to do a layup and you're critical or harsh or punish them for doing it incorrectly, then that's not correction. And so we'll go into a lot more detail next time, unless I go super fast tonight, and then we might get there. Okay, so we're going to talk just briefly about the prefrontal cortex, just so we, a jump start. Remember, it's responsible for our thinking, and so our focused thinking, our abstract thinking, and it helps us with correct behavior in social situations. It collects information from everything around it and tries to organize it. And it's the last region in the brain to develop. Remember, we develop from back to front. And so we're talking about mid-20s before we're fully there. It's to help you be patient. It gives all of us the ability to exercise good judgment. It doesn't mean that we do. It just gives us the ability to do it. Again, brain research indicates that it takes until about age 25 for full brain development to take place. And MRI studies show that in that front-to-back pattern, remember, it's the easy stuff that starts first and the more complex stuff that comes later. So this is your brain, not really your brain. But let's look at this as a developing brain, okay? This is Spaghetti Junction, back before it was Spaghetti Junction, okay? And then We've got a little more Spaghetti Junction. And then we've got Spaghetti Junction. Look how organized that is, right? We look back here, not so organized. Here, really organized. We're going to get where we need to go, right? Maybe. We've traveled on Spaghetti Junction. We have the potential. The pathways have been laid for us to get where we need to go. That's kind of what happens in the development of the brain. So think about the adolescent brain is the building of Spaghetti Junction. And with that immature prefrontal cortex right here, even when teens understand something, we talked about this a little bit last week, and they understand that it's dangerous, they may still go ahead and do it because the risk does not apply to them. I don't know if you were aware of that. It only applies to others. They have an immunity. It's kind of like the invisibility cloak that Harry Potter has, except theirs is immunity. And so they can even verbalize to you the risks of the behavior and be critical of their friends for doing the same thing because it's stupid and then do it. This is why, okay? This is construction. How many of you have driven through freeway construction? Okay, so what happens in freeway construction? There's detours, lines, you sit there for a long time, frustration. You may think this is in Minneapolis, but you take the detour, you may think that you're going to your goal and you're not there. So this is what happens in the adolescent brain as it's developing, is that there's detours and there's traffic and things get jammed up and it's like, wait, this isn't the road I needed to be on. How do I turn back around and get there? So when you are interacting with your teen and they're frustrating you, I just want you to remember that what's happening in their brain is this major traffic jam. Okay. So again, this is what happens. This is what our prefrontal cortex helps all of us do. Be focused in our attention. Organize our thoughts. Anticipate what's going to happen if we do something. Like, perhaps if I walk really close to this ledge, I could fall over. We anticipate that. We consider the future in our decision making, and we again anticipate what might happen. We are able to balance short-term rewards with long-term gain. So, okay, I'm going to put this at our level. Do I stay up and watch the show that I really like, or do I sleep? So some of you stay up and watch the show, and some of you sleep. So you're balancing your short-term reward with your long-term gain. It's like, well, I can stay up and watch it because I can sleep in tomorrow. But we all do this. Adjusting behavior when the situation changes, impulse control, and delayed gratification. Again, this is something that isn't just related to teens. Modulating intense emotions, inhibiting inappropriate behavior, and then considering multiple concepts. Okay, so that's our brain. Cognitive review. Teens are idealistic. They're looking at different models and they're challenging those models. And because of that, things that they have grown up with, like your values or church values or your cultural values, may lose meaning for them. Part of it is because this is the time when they're learning their own independence. And part of that is pulling away from you. What used to be secure and safe for them now feels tight, like a clothes that are too small. And so they're trying to break free from that to expose themselves to their own learning. And some of that breaking free hurts us. Makes us feel like, what did I do wrong? What am I doing wrong now? And we can become more intense in our teaching because they're obviously not getting it in the gentle way that we're doing it now. So, you know, if what you're doing doesn't work, do it harder and longer and stronger, right? And so then we get This is basic physics. Every action has an equal and opposite reaction. So we're pushing, and what are they doing? Pushing back. The harder we push, the greater pounds per square inch pushing back against us. So we have to figure out a different way to work that. A critical attitude and challenge of parental beliefs can be the result of frustration about the difference between what is real and what is ideal. So they see your life, they might not like what they see, they want something different, and they get real frustrated when that doesn't happen. So some of what they don't like about your life is what you don't like about your life. So if you're super vocal about things that you don't like about your life, then they're going to go, why would I want that? You're telling me to do this so I can be like you, and you don't even like it. So why would I want to do that? That doesn't seem very smart. So when you're fussing, think about what you're saying. Just, you know, if you hate your job and you complain about your job, and then you tell them you would, oh, I think you should go into the same job I have, they're going to be like, that's not very smart. Questions on this? Yeah, Charlie. Yeah, great question, which was, how does ADHD play into cognitive development? So ADHD is when kids don't get enough stimulus in their environment, and so they seek it out in other ways. A lot of times, things that we associate with ADHD can be associated to other things as well. So one example is if a child is very active, that doesn't mean they're hyperactive. It just means that they're more active than this child over here. It can also be that they're having difficulty concentrating because the work is really hard and they don't want to do hard. And so it's finding ways to make hard interesting. With let me think about how I want to say this. So you have to work within what their skill set is. So if what they need is frequent reinforcement, then you set it up so that that's what they're getting. So they, like we talked about with one of your girls last week, is what do they need in order to succeed? And that may mean a lot of experimentation on your part and a lot of extra work for you. And I mean, I'm just saying my mantra when my children were growing up, this will just tell you, this just proves that I'm not a perfect parent, just in case you were worried. My mantra was, don't make extra work for me. So, and they could tell you that. I'd be like, what are you doing? Making extra work? And how do I feel about that? You don't like it? Okay. Don't make extra work for me. But with kids who have learning disabilities or ADHD or other special needs considerations, that's really what we have to do, is this extra work to figure out what works. And it's, I can't give you a, this is what you, yeah. But this is, but ADHD is not, no. The prefrontal cortex is still developed. This is just a different way of learning. Yeah. That's, yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question. It's a different way of learning. Okay, so remember, ideals are not real experiences. When they experience the difficulties of achieving the ideal, then they're less critical of you. So this may not come until they're past their 20s. Hopefully earlier. Comparison of real versus ideal applies to the self as well. So there's a tendency for them to not only be critical of you, but critical of themselves. And this, girls are especially susceptible to this, where they're very critical. I don't measure up. I'm not as pretty. I'm not as smart. I'm not as fast. I'm not as athletic. I'm not as smart. I'm not as whatever. And they kind of get stuck in that. So I don't have this on the slide, but One of the things that happens with girls that doesn't happen with boys is that when girls have a problem, they ruminate on the problem. So it spins around in their head, around and around and around. And how many of you, I'm country, how many of you know what a rut is? Okay, thank you. Whew. So it creates a rut in the road, basically in the brain. It gets stuck in there, so it just becomes the natural fallen place. You know, if you've driven down a road where it was muddy, somebody drove before you, now it's hardened, and you're trying to stay out, you get in the rut. Can you get back out of the rut? Not very easily. And so that happens for girls when they're problem solving. And this is contributes then to depression for them because they're stuck in this negative loop, negative thinking about themselves, super critical. Boys are much less likely to do this. Boys problem solve typically by avoiding or distracting. Is that a surprise? Are either one of those a surprise? Okay, just checking. So they're like, oh, there's this problem. I think I'll work on this. And so it may not help them with the problem, but it does keep them from getting depressed. So, and this is particularly noticeable, again, in adolescence. So I'm not saying that it goes on forever, although I think that... Okay, have votes that say it kind of does. Yeah.
That's kind of leads into what we were talking about last time about letting the kids all you know, make mistakes.
Yeah.
Because that's the only way that they're gonna learn.
Yeah.
Learn what life is really like.
Mm-hmm.
To fall on their face a little bit to see how hard it really is.
Mm-hmm. And so that's where it's really, really hard. The statement was that part with finding the difference between ideal and real is giving your children room to fall, to make mistakes, to recognize the mistakes they made. But the challenge for parents is, but there's a lot of danger there. So I'm willing for them to fall here, but I'm not willing for them to fall here. And when they fall, if they don't have the resources to manage it, then what if they get really depressed and they have all these negative thoughts about themselves, and what happens then? And so it's a controlled fall, right? We're not pushing them down. We're like, yeah, you're going to fall on this one, and I'm going to be here with you as you go, and I'll help you as we problem solve this together. And in that, one of the really important things as a parent, which I was going to talk about next week, but I'll just say it now, is that we have to communicate to them that we love them no matter what. Now, we say that, but we have to actually show that. So they have just made a huge mistake. It's a big one. And you're like, I love you no matter what. My heart is hurting. My heart's breaking for you. My heart's breaking for me. I know this is really hard. I love you no matter what. I'm here with you. And you have to act that, because many times when they're going through their fall, their mistake, they don't want to tell you. Do you know why? Because of how you react. And how are you reacting? Badly? Perhaps. Perhaps. Now, just to take you off the hook a tiny bit, some of you have heard me say this before, but Mary and Joseph left their child in Jerusalem, okay, for days. And when they went back, who did Mary blame? Jesus. So the only two parents in the world who had a perfect child still weren't perfect parents. So we will make mistakes, right? And so just feel okay about that, but be with them, Anne. Yes. Yay. What a great segue. We're getting there in just a minute. Perfect. Yes.
So when the girls are stuck in the rut.
Yeah.
I've noticed that I can help mine get out of the rut.
Uh-huh.
But then there's certain types of ruts that they're stuck in that they fall right back into.
Yep.
And I haven't exactly figured out,
is there a template to get them out of the rut? Is that what you're asking me for?
Well, yeah, is there different, like, is an external pressures rut versus a me pressures rut easier to fall back into?
Yep, we're getting to that in just a minute, too.
Okay.
You guys are great. You're, like, leading the way. Okay, emotional development. Emotions provide the basis for a person to sense the state of another. The experiencing is what produces compassion. So, if I have... if I'm feeling sad, and I've experienced sadness myself, when I see someone else who is sad, the fact that I have experienced it helps me relate to that person differently. So this begins in infancy. So unless you have new babies, you guys are already too late for this part. But maybe you can... coach people around you. This is where it begins in infancy. Your child has an emotion, and you respond to their emotion. And verbalizing it helps them. So, I'm sorry you're feeling sad, or that really hurt. So you're putting language to what they're going through. And you're attending to their needs. You know, they fell down, they bumped their knee. It's like, I'm sorry, you're okay. It's going to be fine. We'll put a Band-Aid on it or kiss it or whatever. You're attending to them so they feel emotionally cared for. And by that, they start to feel emotionally caring of you. Do you remember that? When your kids were little and they would do nice things for you because they liked you? A long time ago? So the goal is that we as parents, and we can still do this no matter what their age, is that the goal is that we amplify positive emotions. That doesn't mean we make them bigger. We don't go, oh, I'm so happy. We don't do that. But we acknowledge those positive feelings. And then when they're feeling a lot of negative feelings, we help modulate it. So we don't feed the drama. Does that make sense? Like, okay, I know you're upset. I'm just telling you, my daughter got a little bit dramatic the other night, and I was in Norfolk, Virginia, and she was on the phone, and she was like, I just can't deal with that. I'm going to leave. I'm like, leave then. She's like, what? I'm like, okay, I didn't handle that well. I was not modulating her negative emotion, right? I was like over it. So don't do that. be like, okay, help them kind of walk through. I know you're feeling really upset, angry, frustrated about this. Let's think about how we can problem solve this. What are some things we can do? Think practical ways to help them modulate those negative emotions. That goes with what you were talking about, Anne. So when we use emotion words, and try and expand your vocabulary here. If you're not sure what they are, you can Google emotion words and come up with lots of them. But, if you're only stuck in just like, I'm really mad, then where I'm really angry, or whatever, that's not going to be helpful for them. I'm overwhelmed, I'm disappointed, I'm uncertain, I'm confused, because these are words that they need to learn to use, identify what they are in themselves, and then use, so that when you are talking to them about things that are going on in their life, they can correctly communicate with you what's going on instead of giving you a word that could mean too many things. Does that make sense? Okay. All right. So the sense of attunement that we get by developing compassion encourages group engagement. So the more we have in common with people, the more connected we feel, the more we join with them in communal behavior. This can be a positive, like it is for us at church, or it could be a negative. It could go the wrong direction, right? Like, oh, these are my people, we're going to go party. Mm-mm. We are hardwired to express emotion on our face. Some of us need to work on our poker face, because we're hardwired. And so if we're annoyed, it probably shows up. And our children see that, and they know you're annoyed. They probably identify it faster than you do. Like, there's that look. I see it now. We also pay closer attention to nonverbal cues, like tone of voice, gestures, or expressions, more than verbal expression. So I've used this analogy before, so it might be familiar to some of you, but when you think about communication, and I usually use this with couples, we think, if I say, I feel very strongly about this thing, and so if I say it with a lot of intensity, my partner will know that I'm really serious about it. So my analogy is, if I have something that's really important that I want to communicate to Chad, and I put it on a really nice paper, and then I wrap it around a rock, put a rubber band on there so it stays, and I throw it through his window, did the message get delivered?
Yes.
Yes. Did he pay attention to it?
No.
No, he paid attention to the delivery, but he didn't pay attention to the message. So the value of the message was lost because he's looking at the damage that was done to his window, right? So look, I'm going to try a different way. I'm going to take my really important message. I'm going to wrap it around the shaft of an arrow because I have a little farther distance to shoot it. Okay. And so Sally. I'm shooting it at Sally. I really want her to get, and look, she's in the back row. I mean, I have to get this a long way. So I shoot my arrow, hits her in the arm. Did she get my message?
No.
She's wounded by my delivery, right? I have wounded her. So that's all she can pay attention to is the wound. So that obviously didn't work. So I take my beautiful paper, and I write in this, like, really detailed script in flowery language. And I send it to Mike. And he's like, what is she talking about? Now, he got the message, but it was so vague and indirect. He still doesn't know what I mean, right? So sometimes we do that. Sometimes we're hard and harsh in our delivery. Sometimes we beat around the bush to the point that the other person has no idea what we're talking about. So how do we deliver a message that's important in a way that can actually be received by the other people, the person? How do we do that? In their language. What else?
Short and simple.
At the right time.
At the right time. Timing's super important. Or with modulated emotion, so manage not all emotion, right? There could be, you could say, that was really hurtful. So you're communicating emotion, but you're not, like, screaming at them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. Being considerate, thinking, what's my goal? My goal is that they're able to receive this and respond. So am I delivering it in a way that allows that to happen? Oops, lost my... Oh, for sure. For sure. I get that. Yeah.
So, I'm just curious because we all
It's your voice. It's all of those things.
Yes.
And so then there's a point where I just go, I'm not going to give you a message.
Mm-hmm. So were you here last week when we talked about sensory sensitivity?
I came at the very end.
Okay. So we'll do a brief review. Sensory sensitivity. Adolescents in particular are very sensitive to all of those things. So how many of you have gone to a 7-Eleven with your children? How many of you have had your children go, do you hear that horrible noise? Two? Did you know that there's a terrible noise outside 7-Eleven? It's a very high-pitched whine. It's to keep them from congregating. It's super annoying. It bothers them. We can't hear it because we have old ears. Yes. So they have these things in places where anywhere where they don't want young adolescents to congregate, they put this loud whiny noise. 7-Eleven is only one of the many places they do this. And so my kids would be like, oh, my ears. And I'm like, what's wrong with you? It's real. So if they're like that at 7-Eleven, they're like that with our voices too. And unfortunately for us girls, the higher the pitch, the more sensitive they are to it. So speak in your bass voice. Sorry. Yeah, your synthesized voice. Dad, say it. Well, so the question is that why we have better conversations in the car when they can't see our face? It's both that they can't see our face and that they know we can't see their face. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's distraction, right? So you're doing something else. It doesn't even have to be in the car. It can be in a walk. I mean, for when I lived in San Diego where the weather is always perfect, I did therapy with adolescents outside, and we would do laps. Because if I sat in the room with them and looked at them, they'd be like, fine, okay, I guess. But if we walked laps, they were like a jabberbox. So, but it does eliminate some of those cues that are triggers for them. Yeah, good job. Okay, language, posture, movement, and signals from the heart intestines are all mediated on the right side of your brain. What? Your heart and intestines? Now, when you think about it, when you're feeling something, don't you feel it in your heart and your tummy, right? Chest and tummy kind of gets engaged. It's actually because of the vagus nerve that runs from your brain down through your chest, past your heart, and into your tummy. And when we are stressed, that gets triggered, and so it like zaps everything. It makes us feel uncomfortable. Or sometimes we even feel pain associated with that or nausea associated with that. So it's not just in your head that when you're feeling really stressed that you're feeling this. But it's also not in your adolescent's head either. When they go, I'm really stressed, and my chest hurts, and I have a stomach ache, and you're like, you were just trying to get out of going to school. Maybe they are, but maybe they're really stressed. Emotion goes into both sides. It's moderated by both sides of the brain, but our experience of emotion is on the right side of our brain. So this is where our emotional memory is, where our emotional, where empathy sits. So we can cognitively, like intellectually understand emotion and get triggered on both sides, but we respond on the right. So we're going to do a little experiment. I'm going to play some music, and I want you all, while I play this, to plug your left ear and only listen with your right, okay? We ready? Okay. Do I need to do something? Oh, the next slide over.
Yes,
other ear. Okay, anybody notice a difference? What's the difference? More bass on the left. Anything else? Any other difference? More visual? Okay. You notice more words on the left when you were listening on the left? Okay. More clapping you noticed on the left? Anne? No response? Okay. See?
I actually, part of it's because it was first time, second time through. First time through, I was focused more on him. And the second time through, I noticed more of who he was touching and in contact with.
Okay. Yeah.
I felt Michelle. More when I had my left ear plug. My right ear was more kind of like analytical and paying more attention to like what was being said.
Well, just so you know, I checked the lyrics to make sure that they were clean. So, Michael, you had better on the left.
Higher pitch
on the left. Tell me your name, Carol. Yeah. With your right ear, it did. Okay. So, interesting, because it's the left ear that goes straight into the right side of the brain, which is where we experience emotion. So when we listen with our right ear, we're more cognitive, like we're listening to the beat and the words and the details of the song, whereas when we listen with our left, it's more sensory. So we may pay less attention to the words and less attention to the rhythm, but we have a different feeling about it. So practice at home. Maybe it feels different in a big group.
Placebo effect,
yeah. Well, now that you know, you'll be like, oh, yeah, it does work. So there's a general understanding that we can, and this, I'm not saying it's an actual understanding, that can be accomplished through intellect. So we can understand the concept of emotion through intellect. But the perception of experience requires the right side of the brain, that experiential part over here. Empathy and pain sensitivity is also connected. So if I have gone through a painful experience and I am sitting with someone else who is going through a painful experience, it doesn't even have to be the same painful, but it needs to be somewhat similar, I actually will feel pain through empathy. So I will feel clutching in my heart or maybe some twisting in my tummy when I'm sitting with them because of that shared pain that we have. Isn't that interesting? So how many of you, when you're with your children and they're going through something painful, feel that, right? And sometimes we might misinterpret that twisting in our tummy as like anxious nerves because we don't know what to do, and some of it's partly that too, but it's also our connecting with what they're feeling. They've done some other studies where if I'm really anxious, I'm going to make Chad really anxious. Okay, he's going to be, that's what happens when you sit in the front. Sorry. That's why Kenny sat over there tonight. So he's feeling really anxious. If I get within 6 feet of him, the frequency of his heart will connect with the frequency of my heart. And so one of us is going to throw the, is going to shift the other one. Either he's going to make me anxious or I'm going to make him calm. So your child comes to you like that. There she comes. Woof. I tell you, we practiced this for a long time. Did a great job. So your child comes to you, and they're really anxious, and they sit down beside you. You know how you now have the power to help just in your own spirit slow them down. Or they have the ability in their spirit to ramp you up. And it's all about who's going to have greater mind control over what's happening in their own body. Yeah.
So I have a super nerdy question.
Yeah.
For deaf people, for hearing the heart and the frequency,
Is it felt
or is it actually heard? So if deaf people were in the
No, it's felt. Felt. Yeah. Not heard. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you have to be close, you know, like, which is why if you're in an argument with someone, I'm going to get the right name tonight, with Dolly. Like, anyone could be in an argument with Dolly, but she hates being picked on. Okay, Brandy. Shift.
That's just as bad.
Dolly, you have to sit in the middle if you don't want to get called on. That then she's ramped up, and but if I stand way back here, then we can maintain enough distance that we can both stay in our same state, right? So I actually, if I'm trying to help her calm down, I need to get in close enough to her and then control my own breathing and my own heart rate and my own thinking to help her get better under control. And it works. But, Levi.
Does that work for family?
Anybody.
It works. Anybody's scientifically proven that your heart rate matches somebody's when you get within 6 feet of them. You can teach it. So.
Oh, gosh. Yours could be all over the place. Don't try. Yeah. Greg?
I was going to say, in nursing, it's part of the reasons why they do kangaroo care with preemies, where they make you open up your shirt and put the baby against your chest, because you start to regulate the preemie baby's heart, and it makes them stronger. And so hospitals actually practice it. It's called kangaroo care. And they do it all the time to help the preemies thrive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's scientific. It really happens.
Now, it's not that, I mean, you know, it's... Part of it is a conscientious thing. Like, if you are with someone who's highly agitated, you're going to feel uncomfortable. So it's that, okay, let me breathe, let me slow my heart rate down, and then they match. Now, obviously, this isn't 100%. There are people out there who are highly agitated who you're not going to be able to manage that with. But for sure, with your kids, you can lower their heart rate if you lower your heart rate. Now, why is that important? If your heart rate gets too high, that's kind of an inverse relationship. As heart rate goes up, problem-solving ability goes down. So if you're agitated, you shouldn't try problem-solving. This is for couples, too. So lower heart rate, better problem-solving. Your teen comes to you, they're highly agitated, you're trying to problem solve, that's not going to work. So be calm, sit close, talk about things, find out what's going on with them. There's some really, again, we'll talk a little bit more about this next week, but it's getting them in that place where as their heart rate goes down, they can problem solve with you. If you're agitated, you can't problem solve. You might think that you can because you feel a lot of intensity, but feelings don't mean real. Does that make sense? Okay. Yeah. I I'm going to slide down here so I can hear you a little better. Yeah, girls going through a mood swing.
Okay, so you want to calm them down.
Yeah. Okay, girls having a hard time calming down, had a hard day at school, you're trying to help them calm down. Well, it doesn't have to only be girls.
Yeah,
it can be boys, too. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, exactly. How many times do I have to tell you to sit down? But since you ask about girls, remember girls get stuck in their rut, right? So we're going to use a boy tactic, which is distract. So get them focused on something else so that they're out of the rut, and then come back and talk to it later when their heart rate is down, when they're a little bit calmer. With a boy who's agitated? Hard day at school, really emotional. Well, I'll tell you what I did with my boy. And this was kind of an accidental thing that I found. But by the time, so I would get off work, I would pick them up at daycare at like 1 minute to six before the daycare closed. And they started charging me a lot of money. And then we would drive another 30 minutes home. And then it's time to cook dinner, right? And then there's homework, and there's baths, and there's, and so I would be already not in a good place. And they're exhausted from school, and they're wanting to come home and have fun, and they're wanting attention from me, their parent. So my son in particular would invariably get in some kind of trouble, like provoke his sister so that I have to get involved, and I'd be like, Mom, I didn't do it. So I kind of accidentally one day said, we're just going to leave. Oh, I know. I put dinner in the crock pot. Yay, me. And so I sat and we watched Teen Titans on the sofa, like right beside him. Watched Teen Titans. Didn't say anything. Me, I didn't say anything. Commercial came. We talked about the show. We didn't talk about school or, hey, when the show's over, you have homework, or don't forget you have to do this. Like, I didn't nag. Pretty miraculous. And then other half of Teen Titans. Show's over. I'm like, okay, buddy, what do you need to do? Homework. Okay, you get on it, and I'll work on dinner. I'm like, oh. How'd that happen? But it happened for several things. One, he got what he needed, right, was that immediate attention that he hadn't had all day long. I was sitting beside him, and I was relaxed. And so then he was relaxed, and I wasn't nagging.
Yeah, I think of the scripture, carry one another's burdens, and that way fulfill the law of Christ. You know, what, I wish my kid was younger so I could put some of these things into practice, but so much of it comes down to what we're trying to accomplish. And, you know, the thing that between Pachta's class, the class you did a few weeks ago, or a month or so ago, and then the class last week and this week, we're here to guide our children through this very difficult transition.
Mm-hmm.
There was a line that Pachta used that he said, it's a God-ordained period of chaos to transition them to the independent life. And so I said that, and I'm comparing that to what you're saying. It's we're trying to get them there, and to get them there, we have to help them when they're geared up.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're easily angered or we're easily frustrated, we're doing the exact opposite.
Right.
We're causing them not to be able to grow and transition to this independent life, and it makes a lot of sense in terms of what is my goal? Is it to keep my kid from bugging me? Is it to shut my kid down? Is it to guide them through this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, perfect. And this goes back to, remember, emotional development, where we are using, like, we're modeling. In neuropsychology, it's called mirroring. So they have mirror neurons. And so if you see stuff in them, some of it's probably you. Not all of it, because you're not the only people they're being exposed to, right? But some of it is you, and I bet you can identify when it's you. And you're like, oh, that's me. Can I erase that? Okay, let me move on. Thought I was. Oh, sorry, too fast. Okay. Which is exactly what we're talking about here. Oh, sorry. So, frequent and accurate use of emotion language increases both the language, the emotion language, and our sensitivity, emotional sensitivity. So, if we become fluent with this, we also become comfortable with it. How many of you are fluent in your emotional languages? Good. Sally is fluent. Not everybody is. It can be really hard. So, emotion regulation happens when there's balance between emotion and thought. So, people who, this is a continuum, people who are more emotional, people who are more cognitive. The people who fall higher up on the cognitive end have a tendency to be kind of prideful about their cognitive intellect and ability. Now she's like, oh, I shouldn't have bumped him like that. But they're like, yeah, I'm not emotional, I'm intellectual. So they get a little, they kind of look down on those emotional people who can't quite keep it together. And the emotional people on the other end are like, ugh, all of these like tight people over here on the cognitive end who, like, they're rigid and boring. The goal isn't to be at either end. It's to be as close to the middle as you can, where you have balance between cognition and emotion. Because the emotion is what gives you empathy, and the cognition is what lets you know when it's appropriate to use it and how to do so. Right? So I'm going to put a couple slides in here around autism spectrum disorder. So that's what ASD is. And alexithymia. So what is alexithymia? Break it down for me. Go ahead, Neil. Yes. So, it's right there.
Lexi means word in Greek. A is an alpha privative, and thymia is a disease caused by it.
So,
University of Georgia, go dogs!
So alexithymia is the difficulty identifying and labeling one's own emotions. So it's like, I'm feeling something, but I'm not really sure what I'm feeling or what it's called. This affects about 10% of the population, unless the person has autism spectrum disorder, and then it's about half. So it doesn't mean that they don't have empathy, or that they don't have emotion or understand emotion. It's that when they have the emotion, they don't know exactly what it's called and how to describe it in themselves. Now, it's a language, right? It's an emotional, emotions are a language. So if I can't understand my own language, then I can't understand yours either. Even if it's the same emotional language, like I can't read mine, so I can't read yours. Does that make sense? Okay. So social development and ASD, for many kids who have autism spectrum disorder or who have ADHD or who have other learning disabilities, they like being on the computer. Any idea why? It's stimulating. They have control. over their environment, right? How much they engage. No. Set rules. Right. Not social. Yeah, you can go all over the place. So typically, the more time spent on the computer, TV, or games slows development, social development, and increases negative social symptoms. This is for any child, but it's more pronounced in kids with autism spectrum disorder or ADHD. And so the very thing that they're drawn to is the thing that's inhibiting them. And then more time spent reading books, I had to clarify, because I know it's like, well, they're on their Kindle or they're on their iPad or whatever, a book, or an actual book, not an electronic. And in conversation, it doesn't have to be emotional conversation. It can be any kind of conversation. Then that actually decreases any impairment, decreases the likelihood of impairment in social development. So this is, again, pronounced for kids who have autism spectrum or ADHD, but it goes for other kids as well. The less time they're on electronics and the more they're engaged, how basic is this? Oh, in reading and conversation, the more socially, like, developed they'll be. Are you shocked by that? Isn't that what we did? Great question. So anybody know why reading on paper is different than reading electronics? Yeah, so it has to do with the frequency and the light sensitivity in the brain that comes from electronics. So now they do have filters that you can put on, but not everyone has that. But the blue light triggers increased activity in the brain. Increased activity that we're not trying to trigger. Yeah.
So does.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So then, if you were always wearing the corrective apparatus, there would be no difference in the benefits.
You mean reading a book or reading a Kindle?
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. But now on a computer, the risk is that they're not staying on the book, right? That they're going here and going there, and then that diminishes the benefit again. Neil?
Right. I mean, we could talk about this with the teenagers. It's not that it's the device itself that is evil necessarily. It's that all the other things that are causing their brain to do the things that are causing them to not develop the social things you want
right.
to develop. They're being distracted. They're getting social messages from Instagram, Twitter, Snapchat,
yep.
all those things. They're
yep.
making them into the freaks that they're becoming.
Yeah. Okay. I didn't say that. I didn't say that. So, let me follow up on what he said, because what happens is when, like, they're on their computer, and this is for you too, but you're on your computer or you're reading on your phone, and you get a ding, 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 and you're looking. You look in the corner. Because you get a message from so-and-so, message from so-and-so, and you're like, do I want to look at that? What that constant distraction does is actually trigger ADHD-like symptoms, because it teaches us to have short attention spans. And the goal is to help us expand our attention span, not to shorten it. And so that's why electronics are greater risk. And this isn't only for adolescents. I mean, if you pay attention to yourself, I would guess that you're frequently distracted by all of these messages that are coming in, which make it hard for you to maintain an attention span and complete tasks. Question?
Question.
Yeah. I know it.
Everything's going to Chromebooks and everything's online. And how do you, even as teachers, like, you know, I'm like, they won't buy any books anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I have kids who ask for books.
Yeah.
I'm like, they don't buy them. So I'm like, you've got to do it online. You've got to look at the screen instead of having a book. How do you deal with that if 8 hours a day they're looking at screens at school?
Right. Well, and because they're looking at screens 8 hours a day at school, it's really important that that not be what they're reading on at home, that they're reading a book. It was in clinic this week. A family came in, mom and three kids, all teens. And so I work in a job where I teach physicians. And so I watch them as they interact with their patients and then coach them. And not all day, but 3 half-days a week I do this. And so this family came in, three teenagers. Nobody had a phone in their hand. I was shocked. That never happens. And then the physician is saying, you know, what do the kids do for fun? And she goes, well, they go outside and play or they read books. What? Where are you from? It was amazing. Their kids, they were all, they're all sitting there. They're talking politely and to one another. They're attentive and answering questions in full sentences.
They must be homeschooled.
They're not. They're not homeschooled. She said they must be homeschooled. They're not. They go to public school. But I was like, I can't remember the last time I saw this. So it really does work. It's just so hard to do. So I'm going to hurry because we're about out of time. So I'm going to quickly hit identity development. And they go back and forth through these, so it's not like they do one, then they do the next one. They may bounce back and forth. They may never hit one of them. They may hit only one and stay there forever, but it just gives you a brief overview. Diffusion is when they don't really care to explore or commit to anything. So you're like, let's try this. No. Well, how about that? No. Do you want to do that? How about this over here? You want to go spend time with this person? No. It's okay early in the process for them. This could be career development, social development. But they may find it difficult to commit to a path. So this is obviously not a place you want them to stay very long. They have a tendency to put themselves in a controlling environment so they don't have to make the decision, and that's why it's a risky place. They may get in with a controlling dating partner or fall in with a crowd that's controlling. I put gang, but it doesn't have to be a gang. It can just be a crowd that tells them what they do and they follow along. Moratorium, and you don't have to remember the names of these. I put them up there, but I just want you to know the concepts. This is when they're low on commitment but high on exploration. They want to try everything. Oh, I want to do that. I want to try this. I want to play softball. I want to do ice skating. I want to go on a mission trip. I want to, and you're like, do you know how much this stuff costs? They have a lot of potential, but they really like exploring, but they're not necessarily super willing to commit to anything, and they may be inconsistent. So they may go, I want to do ice skating, and you're like, are you sure? I'm not really sure. And you go buy ice skates, and you pay for lessons, and they go one time and go, I don't like it. This is when you're like, you're going. You are going to all those lessons I paid for, and you're working off those ice skates. I'm just telling you right now. But they see the future as kind of their oyster. Like they see a lot of potential in themselves, and so they set big goals. And sometimes those goals are realistic, and sometimes they're just not. But unless they're in their, like, moving out of this phase, go ahead and let them, like, sit there for a while. Because remember, they're inconsistent. So their goal is like, hey, I'm going to play in the NBA. And you're like, probably not. Just saying, I've seen you, and you're not super athletic. But there's no point in having that conversation because they're going to figure it out and lose interest anyway. All right? So don't argue about things you don't need to argue about. Just go, okay, great. There's basketball outside. Foreclosure, high commitment, low exploration. So they are going to do it, but they don't, you know, it's like, why are you going to do that? I don't know. It's just what I'm going to do. They incorporate the goals of others, which may not be their goal. And this we can see in families, like, well, everyone in our family is this, so that's what I'm going to do. And it's like, well, do you want to do that? Well, I don't know. That's just what we do in our family. Or this is my family's expectations of me, and so this is what I'm going to do. And so they do it. And they may do it and be happy there, or they may do it and be like, I'm doing this, but this was never my dream. And then achievement. So it's like the perfect balance of all of those. They have commitment. They're exploring appropriately. They're able to focus what they want. Now, this not at 14 and 15, right? They get there. And those adolescents who move through this then have a greater sense of well-being because of that exploration, because of kind of their own back and forth process in it. Okay, social development is a shift from dependency on you to dependency on their peers. So it's not truly independence, it's just independence from you. Why do they need to be independent from you? Yeah, so they learn. Do you really want them to stay at home forever? I mean, we don't, right? If we do our job well, they leave. The other thing is, they have a strong affinity to people going through similar experiences. That's really not that different than us. Don't we have a strong affinity for people who are going through a similar experience? For a long time, my whole group of people I hang around with were single moms who had kids the same age as mine. Why? Because we were going through the same thing. Like, we were like, I know, right? No rest ever. Like, ever. You go, if only I could just say, could you take care of this tonight? I'm going to go to bed early. But that never happens. So, and they got that. And that's what our teens are doing. Their peers are like them. They're going through the same struggle. They're going through the same emotional stuff. They're going through the same challenges with their parents who just don't understand them and their annoying little brother or sister or whatever. And so they're able to come together and bond with people who get them. They also borrow from their peers. So they borrow ideas. Sometimes the ideas are good and sometimes they're not. It might be like, oh, I hadn't thought about that. That's a good way to do that, to problem solve that. It could be beliefs. So you've been, you know, teaching your child in the way he or she should go, so when they are old, they will not depart from it. You've been consistent in trying to do that. And then they come home and go, so I've been reading a lot about Buddhism, and I want to put a Zen garden in my room. And you're like, what? Yeah, my friend has one. And you're like, okay, let's talk about that. They can borrow behaviors. So I am not a Kardashian fan. I'm just going to say this, okay? But one of them has this, she talks a certain way, like, she kind of gravelly voice. And right when the show came on, all of these girls started talking in that same gravelly voice that she had. I can't do it, but I guess I haven't practiced enough. But they'll do that with each other. You'll notice that all of a sudden they have this kind of speech pattern or word choice, and you're like, where did that come from? And then their friend comes over, and you're like, oh, that's where that came from. Again, it doesn't mean it's bad, but they're borrowing. Why? They're testing it out. Like, do I like this? Do I not like this? No, I don't really like this. Or I do like this. And they borrow status. If you're moderately popular and your friend is popular and you hang out, what happens to you? You become popular, right? At least more popular. You're at least included. So you can, even if you don't have it yourself, you can like hook on with someone and then get a little from them. And they do that. So role of peers, I think I only have two slides left and we'll be done. But there's increased susceptibility to peer influence and risky behavior, mostly for boys, more for boys than girls, grades 5 through 8. So by risky behavior, I'm talking about like, you know, we're going to set fires, jump off. Oh, my gosh, my son did that. I'm like, what are you doing? I'm practicing parkour. No, there's no practicing parkour. Where did you get this idea? Whatever you're watching, stop it right now. So how did you know that? Okay. No hanging around with Levi. Their ability to resist peer pressure starts to improve around age 14. Now, they're not there yet. It just starts to get better. But those middle school years, they're at really high risk. And then people who are under stress affiliate with others. So the higher stress they're in, the more likely they are to seek out other highly stressed kids. Now, there's some danger in this, because this is when you get them taking, like, substances get involved. They're highly stressed, so they're managing their stress with substances. It's like, oh, that'll work for me. Or eating disorders, or cutting, or other risky, dangerous behaviors happen. The higher the stress they're in, the more likely they are to connect with others like that, okay? Peer network. So circle number 3 in the middle, we're starting in reverse order, that's their 1 or 2 close friends. And these may be people you've hand-selected because you're trying to be a good parent and make sure they have the proper social network, right? So these are their church friends, 1 or 2 people. These are the ones that can spend the night with and go do activities. They have more freedom. Then they have 6 to 10 in number 2. Those are the friends that they eat lunch with or they sit together in class. They may not do anything outside of that. They may sit together at a game or that kind of thing, but they may have church friends and school friends. Okay, so the inner circles, probably they may have 1 or 2 church friends and 1 or 2 school friends, and never the twain shall meet, because that would be weird. And then the friends around that are just the school friends, and then the group on the outside, which I didn't get it big enough, but that circle number 1 on the outside, that one's really big, and that's the crowd. That's people at their school who, again, have similar interests or attitudes about things, or they behave in the same way, but they may never spend any time together. Which one of those circles is the most influential for your child? Mike knows. Corey? 1. Yeah. So the one that's going to determine more what they do, things they experiment with, is going to be 1, not the ones that you're bringing in close around them. And it's not that those don't have influence, but they don't have the same level of influence. So what do you do? Greg?
That's what I was going to say. What do you do? It's a lot of pulling away towards peers, and that's a hard enough adjustment on its own. But how do you balance that with, hey, don't forget that family's important?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how do you get that message to that kid who's pulling away developmentally because they're supposed to, but still be like, family's important, family's more important than friends? Like,
and they know family's important. They don't want you to abandon them. And can you hold that till next week? Because we're going to talk about attachment and parenting next week. Okay, so this is my cliffhanger right here. What do you do? Oh, you have to come back next week. That was good, wasn't it? See? No, it wasn't? Now you're going to be stressed all week? Michelle's like, no, I wanted the answer right now. Oh. I'll get you the slides. So that's what we're going to talk about next week, attachment and parenting and how to influence your child when you're working against this peer network. Okay? Questions? Michael?
What if you don't like the peers?
What if you don't like the peers? I can guarantee you you're not going to like all the peers. Yeah, but we'll talk about it next week.
Is that why Pilate had such a big, big problem? Because, I mean, he obviously, maybe he had people close to him, but the crowd really
influenced him. Yeah, and he wasn't even a teenager. Right? One of the things we will talk about next week is the disciples, who were probably functioning with an undeveloped prefrontal cortex, cortices, when they were first recruited.
No comment on that one. So I grew up in an environment where, you know, the big thing was to manufacture these circles.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Right, that had nothing to do with the manufacturer circle. Well, that's not true. Some of the manufacturer circle was on the football team. But where do you draw the line, right? Because some of that seems unhealthy.
Some of the manufacturing?
Yeah. So mm-hmm. I remember the first time I saw Goodfellas, and she's talking about, hey, we were always together. We only went over to each other's houses, and we only did things together, and there were no outsiders ever. And I was like, oh, crap, not in much more colorful language. But, you know, so...
Appropriate to your manufactured circles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how do you balance that or influence that?
Next week. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You talked about learning the language of emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And I said something to Hill. We can send it out to people, but I found this really helpful. Use this with people.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I sent this to a bunch of people, but so, for example, the SAG one, which is about at 9 o'clock, well, what are you really feeling? Is it guilty, ashamed, depressed, lonely, bored, tired? And then even within bored, is it apathetic? And because the solutions, just by trying to fix somebody's sadness, it could be that you all the way up to the end, just they're feeling stupid or inferior, and the solutions are different. So, you ever use that?
No, but I use something different. And the one that I use is that we have primary emotions, and I did this with your kids, your teens. Did I do this with you all? Primary emotions and secondary emotions? No? Okay. Well, I did it with them, so they know it. But primary emotions are like when we feel sadness or embarrassment or joy. And then a secondary emotion, anger, is the biggest one. And how many of you, when you were in science class, did the thing where you put ink, and like ink on a blotter, and then you put it in a solvent, you did black ink, and you saw all the different colors of ink that came out? You missed out. Okay, so never mind, that analogy won't work. But with anger's not a pure emotion. It is a substitute emotion for what else is going on. So we can feel embarrassed and act angry and identify it as anger, even though it's not. It's embarrassment. We can feel betrayed and act angry and define it as anger, but it isn't what we're feeling. We're feeling betrayed. So it's kind of a catch-all. Like, I'm feeling this. It's strong, so it must be anger. I'm going to throw it in there. And so one of the things that I try to do is stop and go, what is it that I'm actually feeling? Like, the only time anger is a primary emotion is when it's righteous indignation. And honestly, how often does that really happen? Not so often, right? So, not that it can't, but that's not really where we're going most of the time. And so if you're feeling angry and you're not righteously indignant, then it's something else, and it's important that you figure out what that is. The other thing, and Tripp reminded me of this, is back in the day when it was like we were teaching the kids, and it was like, you just need to get happy. You just need to stuff your emotions and fake it. You know, not be real about what you're feeling. So it was a disservice that we did because we weren't helping. We weren't using the right language, and we were teaching them that you have to fake the language. You can't really feel what you're feeling, and so We don't want to do that. It's not like just get happy. Okay, I went way over. Sorry. Oh, did we have another question? Okay.